Good evening. I'd like to call to order the May 4th meeting of the Tompkins County Legislature. As you can tell, Martha Robertson is not back from Albany, and when she gets here, I hope she'll take over. Would you all please rise and join me in the pledge to the flag? I pledge allegiance
to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Could you take the roll, Kathy?
Mr. McKenna?
Yep.
Mr. Proto?
Here.
Ms. Pryor?
Here.
Mr. Robinson has asked to be excused this evening. Mr. Shinagawa?
Present.
Mr. Stein?
Here.
Mr. Burbank?
Here.
Ms. Chop?
I am here.
Mr. Dennis?
Here.
Ms. Herrera?
Here.
Ms. Pieper?
Present.
Mr. Lane?
Here.
Ms. McAsey?
Here.
Mrs. McBean Claiborne?
Present.
And Ms. Robertson will be a little late this evening. I have 13 members present.
Proclamations, petitions, communications.
Communications are on the desks.
As far as I know, there are no executive sessions. The agenda shows something slightly out of order. The presentation listed under number 3 actually belongs under number 6, presentations, special topic. So we will turn to privilege of the floor for the public. Do you have any cards? Thank you. I have two people who have signed up ahead of time that I will ask to speak. If there are other people also wishing to speak, just come to the microphone and let us know. I'll first call Deborah Dietrich.
Hi, all. I'm here to just speak really briefly about OAR before you're all totally inundated with budget issues, and the attention will be totally on the dollars and not on the program so much. I'd also like to invite you all, I think you've gotten written invitations, but we're having our annual meeting next Wednesday evening at the Ithaca Community Recovery Building in the first floor meeting room from 4:30 to 6. And really it'll be very low key. We're going to have a number of clients talk about the work they've been doing over the last year, some of the changes that they've made in their lives. And just, it'll be very low-key and enjoyable, I think. So we urge you to come. You're all more than welcome. I brought a little bit of background information. I'm really here because I know there's some new legislators who may not be familiar with OAR. OAR has been around since 1976, and we're still going strong. It started as a volunteer organization and really provided kind of friendship and transportation for people in the jail, for families to visit them. It's become a nonprofit in its own right over the last several couple decades. Basically, we've shrunk due to budget constraints from 4.3 FTEs last year down to 3.6 FTEs, but we're doing the same amount of work so far. Our programs are pretty wide-ranging, but they fall into a couple major categories, and I'll just break it down. Bail fund, which is important to many of you, and most of you know about it, because the bail fund, until about 5 years ago, was solely funded by individual donations, and 5 years ago, the county legislature made its first appropriation to the OAR bail fund, realizing that the bail fund allows OAR to bail people out of jail who are only accused of a crime, who are awaiting trial, who would be out if they had the means to bail themselves out. So it basically equals the financial playing field so that those who are poorer have the same ability to help in their defense and be out of jail pending trial. We have limitations, $2,500, and so there are a limited number of people we bail, but last year we bailed 51 people out. Which saved the county conservatively about $215,000. That's a pretty conservative estimate. The other programs we do are clients, we call client services. Those are for people who are both in jail and out of jail. In jail, we're up there 4 afternoons a week. We do all the intake for the assigned counsel program. We meet with people, assist them with applications for other public assistance when they should get out. We assist them with a whole variety of things that they need when they're in jail. We have a list of service units now. We started to quantify what we do, but it's a little bit illusory because the 3,400 of our client service units, we're providing writing supplies. Basically, what we do is we provide paper and addressed or stamped envelopes to inmates at the Tompkins County Jail so that they can maintain contact with family and friends. We also have a drop-in center where their family and friends come down to receive free phone calls from the county jail. That's somewhat timely because I understand that you all are looking at an increase in the cost of calls from the jail to families or others that people want to call from the jail. And many of our clients' families cannot afford to accept collect calls from the jail through Global Telelink or any other provider for that matter. To accept calls from the jail, you really need to have a credit card. Many of our clients don't have credit cards. And so our phone allows families to come in and sit there and wait for calls from their loved ones in jail and talk to them there. We also provide client services, a lot of them for those who've gotten out of jail. OAR begins its work with people planning for their transition as soon as they're admitted to jail. We meet with them, we help plan, help them figure out what it is they're going to need to do when they get out. By and large, most people who are at the Tompkins County Jail are sentenced to a year or less. Otherwise, they go on to state prison. And so they need to start making plans for their transition back into the community. So we help with a number of things there. And then they use our drop-in center when they get out of jail for a job search, housing search. And we try to line some of that stuff up before they get out. So those are really very brief highlights, but those are the main points of what OAR does and what it's been doing since 1976. And I look forward to giving you any more detail and invite you again to join us at our annual meeting. And we'll definitely be seeing you all during the budget season, too. So thank you.
Thank you, Deborah. Another Deborah. Deborah Cowan, please. As you know, there's supposed to be a 3-minute time limit. If you could just state your name again and your location.
I should make it. I time myself out and practice at home. So, thank you. My name is Deborah Cowan. I live at 1022 Hanshaw Road, and I'm here tonight to talk about the Hanshaw Road reconstruction project. I would like to try to explain a little bit how we feel as individual homeowners. It may seem to you that we have plenty of information, but from here, the information feels incomplete and contradictory and confusing. It's important when you are delivering information to find out whether the intended recipient is getting what you are saying.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
Could you get closer to the microphone?
I'm sorry.
Please? Thank you.
Is that helpful?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. I think the neighbors of Hanshaw Road are telling you that they don't get it. Many of us expressed concerns at the eminent domain hearing, and we have since submitted to you 47 letters, 35 from people on the acquisitions list, and 12 from people not on the list, all expressing concerns about the county's claimed right-of-way and the effect of the project on their property and the road as a whole. This is over half the neighborhood. What I continue to hear from my neighbors is that they don't know what is going on. They have trouble deciphering your maps, trouble understanding the easement language, trouble figuring out where the sidewalk will be on their property, and what it will look like over the course of the road. They are, as they have been for the last 5 years, extremely concerned with the safety of the road and road speeds. I'm not sure if you have looked at the primary material, so I submitted, and they're in your mailboxes, an example of what we were given in our acquisition packets. I've copied a neighbor's map because it's one of the more egregious examples, and I would challenge you to make sense of it and have a level of comfort with it. As legislators, you've probably been through this type of road design and construction many times before. Please remember that for the vast majority of us, this is our first time. our homes in our neighborhood will be affected forever, and we want to make sure that we understand what's happening, and we want to make sure that you get it right. And if you could please think about this as a homeowner, if you were to hire a contractor to build an addition to your home or a landscaper to put in a walkway and plantings, you would not proceed with work unless you had blueprints or diagrams telling you exactly what would be constructed, the dimensions and locations, and how it would affect your property as a whole. If you didn't have this information, you would be foolish to sign a contract, and that's how we feel, that we so and so would we be. Our last public informational hearing was almost 3 years ago in 2007. I'm not counting the open house held before the eminent domain hearing since the maps there were inaccurate and out of date. In these 3 years, people have moved away, new people have moved in, people still here have forgotten what they once knew. We've come here to ask for your help. While here, we can comment but get no answers. We can write or email, but are told our questions will be passed on to staff and answered in a report at some later date. There seems to be no opportunity for dialogue available to us, and it feels a bit as if we're being held at arm's length. We are not really happy with the thought that staff is the intermediary between us and our elected representatives. We would like access to and answers from you, the legislators, the decision makers in the project. And so we are hopeful and asking for a dialogue with you so that we can be clear on what's ahead. We're asking that you hold a public informational forum with legislative members present to answer our questions and address our concerns. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to speak? There's another card.
Yes, it's Jessica Yoon.
Mm-hmm. Here's three more. There's a couple more signs up back here.
Susan Rhea, I'm a town board member, Ithaca Town Board, and just want to express a few thoughts from the town of Ithaca. One is the town board has informally supported the county sale of the Biggs property to the hospital. We like that idea. At the same time, we'd like to be kept in the loop about the other 26 acres and what's the plan going to be for them. As you know, we're actively working on plans for development up by the hospital, so it'd be good to have a sense of what the county is planning to do in that area as we make plans. Right across the street, we're dealing with Cornell right now on potentially rezoning right across from the hospital. So that's one thing. The other thing, really short, is just that the town is pleased to be working on a number of issues with the county, and those include road preservation laws. We think it's important to get those in place before New York State ends its moratorium on gas well drilling. Cell tower issues, we think that's really a good move to have us look at that countywide. Animal control issues, which I guess have just come on the docket. We're pleased to be working with the county on traffic calming in Forest Home, and we're very, very supportive of the health insurance consortium and all the effort that the county has put in toward that, since it will be benefit the town of Ithaca. Thank you.
Susan, thank you. I want to apologize to other members of the public who may be here because I didn't recognize you as a municipal official, which is the next category of speakers. So, are there other members of the public who wish to speak? Could you state your name and where you're from, please?
Yes. My name is Eric Banford. I live on East Miller Road in Danby, New York. I'm a member of the Danby Gas Drilling Task Force, Shell Shock Citizens Action Alliance, and the Tompkins County Environmental Management Council, though I'm not here representing any of those groups. I'm here as a concerned citizen of this community. I've been active in the past year helping to educate this community about the inherent risks that come with high-volume horizontal hydraulic fracturing for gas in the Marcellus Shale, and in that effort, I felt an overwhelming need to find something positive to say yes to. We don't have the luxury or the right to say, not in my backyard, when our energy has to come from somewhere. Right now, our coal-fired electricity from Milliken Station is in part responsible for mountaintop removal in the neighboring states south of New York, and I find that unacceptable. Our energy has to come from somewhere, and it should come from our own backyard. So if not hydraulic fracturing and not coal, what do we say yes to? I think the answer is wind, and specifically I think the Enfield Wind Farm. As a lifelong birder, I was initially skeptical of wind turbines and their threat to migrating and local bird populations. So I have been studying their development closely. When the Mount Pleasant site was proposed, I did bird walks there to see if that was a good site or not, because good siting makes all the difference. And I think the Enfield Wind Farm is a good site. I talked to John Rancich about birds and bats and everything I could think of question-wise about his plans, and I think this is a well-thought-out plan. The 50 megawatts of power it will generate will be enough for all of the homes in Tompkins County, and that, to me, is walking the walk. If we can do that, we can power all of Tompkins County on wind and solar, and then we could look at transforming our transportation to electricity as well. We could be leading by example. The reason I came here today was to encourage you to think about funding this project so that our community owns it and operates it, and it's a community resource. A study by the Institute for Local Self-Reliance entitled Energy Self-Reliant States found that New York State could generate 90% of its power from renewables, and that is a conservative estimate. They found also that a locally owned 50 megawatt wind farm could generate, by my approximation, $6.5 million annually for a community, whereas an absentee-owned farm would only generate $2.5 million. And for an approximately $115 million investment, I think that's an incredible opportunity that we should not pass up. If we own it, we can set future prices, keep them stable, whereas if we do not, we'll be at the mercy of the market, which will inevitably go up as fossil fuels become harder and harder to extract. Through the money that NYSERDA has available, through the alternative energy manufacturing tax credits that President Obama just made available, and through the stimulus money being made available, we should find a way to finance this project. It means jobs, it means clean energy, and it means a more secure future for Tompkins County. Please consider this proposal. Thank you.
Thank you. If you have a written version of your comments, if you want to pass it in, we could use it.
Yes, I do.
Thank you. I have a card from Jessica Yoon.
Hi, my name is Jessica Yoon. I live at 211 Linden Avenue. I'm an intern at the Tompkins County Workers Center, and I'm also a student over at Cornell. And I'm here to tell you about a project that we're working on at the Workers Center and hoping to, I guess, put it on your radar for discussion and see what kind of support we can get from the county. You guys probably remember back in the summertime of 2009, the Department of Labor conducted a sweep of restaurants in the downtown area and found all sorts of labor violations. And in the aftermath of that, at the Workers Center, we felt that we noticed that a lot of the restaurant owners that had been charged with violations during that sweep were not really knowledgeable of the laws and didn't feel that they had access to the information that they needed to uphold the law. So we've been working on putting together a manual of labor laws and just very specific laws that are catered towards restaurants, because there's a lot of little details that kind of get missed in that. And we're working on putting together this manual, and currently we're in the phase of trying to get it checked for legality by an expert or a lawyer on labor law, maybe at Cornell. So we're hoping to put this together, and in thinking of how we're going to distribute it, we were thinking that the Tompkins County Legislature would be a good place to bring it forward for discussion, because places like the Health Department are kind of the only, I guess, organizations that have access to like a comprehensive list of all the restaurants in our area. So we're hoping that we'll be able to maybe work together with the county to get this manual distributed so that businesses in Ithaca have the knowledge they need to be law-abiding employers. I guess what we're hoping for is just to inform you what we're trying to work on, about what we're trying to work on, and to see what kind of support we can get in terms of printing it and working with the health department to get the list of contacts in order to distribute it. And I think in the end it would be really beneficial for the whole community. We wouldn't have PR nightmares of lots of violations and labor sweeps, and we would have done our part to make sure that businesses and people opening new businesses and new restaurants have an understandable manual to navigate all the complicated laws in the restaurant industry. So just letting you know about that. Thanks.
Thank you, Jessica. Is there any other member of the public who would like to speak? Is Ms. Cowan still there? No.
She left.
She left. Okay. I was prepared to make some comments on behalf of the legislature about Hanshaw Road, but if she's left, I will spare you all that. And I think I saw Martha come in somewhere. But before she takes over, I would like to move on to privilege of the floor for legislators, and in particular, we have a youth award. Dave McKenna, will you take over, please?
Good evening. A couple months ago, when I first found out that I had to do this, I went on a search mission to find a candidate that I felt lived up to the standards that we needed, and admittedly, preferably in my hometown. So I went to the school and asked them for help, and about 2 weeks later, I got a really enthusiastic letter from Rick Paulwitz about a young lady who seems to be doing an excellent job holding a 97 point grade point average through high school. Is not an easy thing. And I've also asked Rick to come up and make a few comments. So Rick and Samantha and Mom, if you could all come up, it would be nice.
One thing that I should have, or I didn't include in my notes here, were that Sam is a certified CPR and first aid, which we needed a couple minutes ago, and my son fell on his head, and you may have seen the blood outside of the courthouse, so I'm going to have to go to the hospital as soon as I do this presentation. But Sam is extraordinary, to say the least. She's viewed by the faculty, the staff, and her peers as an individual who's deserving of this recognition for her selfless contribution to the school, to the Newfield community, and to the causes that spread beyond the Newfield borders. Much of her volunteer service is generated around helping children to live better lives. She's helped plan, organize, and participate in activities such as the pre-kindergarten registration, the Girls Club, where she's worked with younger students on issues of self-confidence, self-esteem, and body image, the annual health fair, where she promotes healthy habits and good decision-making, and she's even done some fun holiday activities such as gingerbread house making and community caroling. She's also spent numerous hours over the past couple of years working one-to-one with students with significant academic needs. Her efforts often extend up and beyond the school day and the school year. She's volunteered her time in our summer day camp as a counselor in training, which subsequently led to a position as a full-time counselor. In addition to her work with children, Sam's volunteered her time to work in the box Tops for Education, which raises a significant amount of money for our school, the National Honor Society, where she served as treasurer for the past 2 years, our community canned food drive, and the Change for Change scholarship program. Sam's also helped with two unique community events where she's worked with the elderly community members through the Garden Apartments renovation project, as well as one of my favorites and two recipients who are running out there, one with blood on his head, but the three-year-old community holiday gift project, where in our school a lot of our students will come together, create little packages for all of the three-year-olds in our community to start working on fine motor skills and things in preparation for the pre-kindergarten programming. So Sam's very involved in that. She even found some time this year to work on, I think, organizing and participating in the cancer run as well. The truly amazing thing about Sam is how she manages all of these things, in addition to having a 97 cumulative GPA, holding down a part-time job, as well as all the other clubs and activities that she does. Much of the time that she has up and beyond the school, actually there's not much of it, but she does devote to one of her passions, and that's volleyball. She's excelled on the court as she has in the classroom and in the community. She's received many athletic accolades and has been recognized as one of the area's best athletic talents. Sam will continue competing next year at the collegiate level. Sam's scheduled to graduate this June with an advanced Regents diploma with honors. Her cumulative GPA is nearly a 97, and she will have completed the equivalence of one full year of college before she walks and receives her diploma. She'll have 33 credits accumulated. She's committed herself to attend and play volleyball in the fall at Alfred University, where she plans to pursue a degree in forensic science. Now, all of this, you have to give some credit to Mom, all right? Now, don't hold back the tears, all right? But, Mom, you've done a wonderful job. And, Sam, my 16 years in this job, there are very, very few students that have come across my desk that have moved me, I'm hoping, as maybe as much as I moved you. But congratulations. You are certainly
So, on behalf of the Tompkins County Legislature, I'd like to award Sam the Tompkins County Distinguished Youth Award in recognition of outstanding commitment to the community. And this was for April because she was busy doing her thing and we couldn't get here. Okay. And it's sponsored by Bangs Ambulance Service, Tompkins County Legislature, Cougar Radio Group, Purity Ice Cream, A and B Awards and Engraving. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Hello. Are there any other legislators with something to say tonight? Carol.
Yeah. I want to first thank Ms. Yoon for coming to speak to us and for trying to come up with something constructive to do in relation to a community problem, what has become a community problem. I had occasion in my past to open a business, a very small business, a one-person business, and it was very difficult to figure out what I had to comply with. You know, my good luck to you in trying to sort this out and try to help make it understandable. And I hope at some point you can refer this to the appropriate committee. I want to mention two meetings that I have had occasion to attend in the past couple of days. One relates to Marcellus Shale. A new aspect of this that we may have to contend with, which are disposal wells. There was a session last night, and the important thing to know about them is these are wells that are dug into the ground, drilled into the ground, to help dispose of what comes back up. And currently the regulations, the EPA regulations, the good news is that they are regulated in ways by both federal, state, and possibly are subject to local regulations in ways that the primary wells may not be. That's the good news, bad news scenario. The bad news is that the regulations were designed in the 1970s around the principle that we were putting back into the ground what came out of the ground minus what the gas that was taken out of it, primarily brine, and you put what was left back down into the ground to the same place it came from, the same level of shale that it came from. And this, as we know, is a different animal. So watch for more about that. And then this morning, I want to say a word about the Chamora economic but the Chamora analysis of the profile of visitors to Tompkins County. We've been asking the Strategic Tourism Planning Board for years, how do you know who's coming here and how do you know that our dollars are influencing who comes here? And the answer really is we don't entirely know. We know a lot about hotel rooms. We know a lot about how those have been greased. We had known a lot about bed nights, but not as much about the actual visitors. So they finally commissioned a study, there's a whole CD. There's a link to it on the county website now. Go to Tompkins County website, the administrators page, and there's a link through there. Among the findings, the county has attracted more than 840,000 visitors in 2009 that generated $156 million in associated spending and supported more than 2,300 jobs. One very interesting, there's all kinds of interesting facts. One interesting fact is that only 47% of our visitors came here specifically for college and university related activity, not related, activity, people visiting the colleges, which left 53% of our visitors are coming here for other purposes. I thought that's one factoid there among very, very many. So I encourage you to all look at it. Thank you.
Thank you, Carol. Anyone else? Mike, then Frank, and Will.
35 days at the state level without a budget. I hope that you mentioned that to the folks in Albany today, Madam Chair. The problem is that when the budget is being talked about and so late, that other legislation doesn't happen. Home rule legislation is held back. Legislation that our county needs, legislation that other counties need. What does go through are these kinds of bills that the Senate and Assembly members can say, see what I did? It's usually not a dollar figure, at least they don't think it is, until it comes back to us as some kind of a mandate. One of those things that is about to happen, we understand, is a change in the open meetings law that's been proposed that could be potentially expensive for Tompkins and other counties. It has to do with requirement of publishing all of our records having to do with a meeting on the website at least 24 hours before the meeting. Not just the agenda, not just proposed resolutions like we always do, but all the backup material. And I think this could be very time-consuming for our staff and very difficult to comply with. So I would like us to be taking a look at this and taking it back to GO and whether or not we need to respond to this in some way. Apparently this is poised to be adopted in the Assembly. These are the kind of things. Leandra's Law is another one. You know, it has a great potential protection for people, but the actual implementation of it is going to be so difficult with the interlocks for the folks that have cars that have been arrested for driving while intoxicated. Where's the money going to come from to make this work? Are we at the county level going to be subjected to those additional costs? Sort of a backdoor mandate that we find. So those are some of the things that are happening, and it's affecting us here at the county level. The late budget means we're about to vote on our school district budgets without those folks and the boards of education knowing what the real figures are, and it's hard for them, and so they're looking at cuts and layoffs that maybe or maybe they wouldn't have to have if we had a budget in place.
Thank you, Mike. If I can just answer Leandra's Law, maybe Nathan, if you wanted to add in or Joe, what we are told, I believe, is that they're working with the manufacturers. The state has heard this concern. They're working with manufacturers so that the pricing would be bumped up 10% to people who can pay, and people who meet certain, you know, their income is below a certain level, would then be, it would be free from the manufacturer of these interlock devices. But that, as Pat Buchel told, I think, Public Safety, that that assumes that only 10% of the people involved are indigent, and it's probably the other way around. Maybe 10% can actually pay for the devices. So there's maybe an attempt, but a little awkward and not sure it'll work. Did you want to add anything? But you're right, Mike. There's a lot of that goes on, I'm afraid. Frank, and then Will.
Thank you, Martha. Glad you made it back. I hope it was successful.
So do I.
One of the items that I added to Martha's list, I don't know if you had a chance to read it, was the impact of the sluggishness and what it's costing the state in not passing legislation that established the video gaming, the VLTs at Aqueduct. I know you may think, well, gambling, da-da-da-da-da. However, it's costing the state, it cost the state over the last several years $2.4 to $2.6 billion in lost revenue because the folks are going to Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Canada. And the impact of the 40,000 acres and 43,000 acres and the potential of losing 400 farms statewide is devastating. There's 35,000 people employed in the industry, and it's not just horse racing, by the way. It's anything to do with horses and horse breeding, a lot of support services. And I hope you had a chance to mention that to Assemblyman Silver. The two items, or three items I did want to mention, just a reminder again that Veterans Day is coming up, and in your communities, if you have a veterans organization, they are not all VFWs. Some are American Legion, and some are veterans organizations like the Vietnam Veterans Organization. Please pay attention to who needs flags for decoration, if you will, in the cemeteries. We're in the process of buying and supplying the local VFW with about between 500 and 600 flags, and we'd like to make sure they get appropriately distributed. So if you have an organization that needs them, please contact the VFW. Secondly, the next chapter in the never-ending saga of the NYSEG rate increase proposal. 2 weeks ago, if you recall, we had an opportunity to submit comments to the Public Service Commission in Binghamton. I want to draw your attention to an article that was in the Journal last week that indicated that if the rate increases that NYSEG is asking for go through, the average, and I don't know what constitutes average, but these are the numbers that were supplied by Iberdrola. The average increase in utility costs to the homeowner in this state served by NYSEG will be $230 a year. May not seem like a lot, but the concern is that they still have not produced the report that they indicated they would produce regarding maintenance of the electric lines. That's $12.47 a month for the average natural gas heating bill and $6.70 a month for the average electric bill. Why I'm adamant about this is because of the maintenance that did not take place 5 or 6 years ago during that ice storm, and we're still waiting for Iberdrola's report on how they're going to maintain the lines. On the heels of that, just so in case you missed the article, Iberdrola reported a profit increase of 16%, and that translates to, these numbers are impressive, $1.22 billion. And in the United States, as part of that number, it was significant. They didn't break it down by dollar volume. They broke it down, and Mr. Rancic will appreciate this, they broke it down by megawatts. And it was very impressive to see this company's not going broke, folks. And it's irritating. Anyway, the PSC did acknowledge the comments that, of course, I wasn't appointed by this board to do this, but you know that this is my favorite topic, and the consumer affairs piece is important. The PSC acknowledged receipt of the comments again, and we hope that they'll react. There were over 100 people that spoke, and none were happy, believe me. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Frank. Will?
Thank you, Martha. As you may have heard, there was a very tragic fire over the weekend out in Caroline. A double-wide trailer was engulfed in flames, and some 40 to 50 of our firefighters responded. People from Slaterville, Danby, Speedsville, Varna, Brooktondale, and Richford all turned out. And unfortunately, one of our citizens died in the process. His name was Tom Fox. That was all in the paper. What was not reported in the paper was that Tom actually was a former county employee. He used to work for mental health. And I sent an email off this morning to Bob DeLuca, and he confirmed what I had feared. And said that Tom had retired several years ago, but he's definitely remembered by the department for his concern for all of his clients without regard to diagnosis or label, and his desire to figure out a way to help people navigate the system and get what they need. I knew Tom perfectly because my wife used to work for Meadow House many, many years ago, and I was always struck by Tom's wonderful sense of humor and ability to engage with all sorts of people, regardless of their station in life. He was just an amazing person, and he will be missed. I'm not going to call for the customary moment of silence, but I would invite everybody, if you happen to have known Tom or anybody listening out there knows, go to the Journal's obituary site. They have a wonderful place where you can leave a message of concern to the family. And I'm told there will likely be a memorial service sometime later in the summer. Tom was part of a large community of mental health workers, volunteers, and people involved in using the services who will be celebrated later this month. And you should all have gotten this card in your mailbox. It's a celebration and recognition of the community of care that serve the people of Tompkins County. It's happening at the Holiday Inn downtown on May 25th from 5 to 7. I went last year, and I found it just a very, very informative and inspiring kind of event. So I would encourage all of you to consider going. Thank you, Martha.
Thank you, Will. Appreciate the knowing about Mr. Fox. Thank you. Anyone else? I just want to... Oh, Pam.
I have one... I just want to report that in the never-ending story of the garbage truck problem that we have in Tompkins County, tomorrow the Upstate Task Force is meeting here in Ithaca, and they're meeting with somebody from the governor's office. And we are hoping that finally there will be some light shed on whether the regulations, proposed regulations, are on the table or off the table. That has been shifting in many different directions depending on I don't know what. But anyway, I will hopefully have something to report at our next meeting, because I think this is an issue that for those of us who are being affected by these trucks, it is just nothing short of a nightmare, and we really need to continue to seek some relief for the people who are being affected by it.
Thank you, Pam. Nathan? Thank you.
Pam, is there going to be a representative from Senator Schumer's office?
There usually is. Okay. There usually is. Actually, last meeting there were two.
Oh, cool. Great.
Carol?
I have a question for Pam as well. Would you like us to find a location for that meeting? One of my constituents' homes along East State Street?
Yeah.
I'm being serious.
Well, thank you, but we have a site, and I think we're trying to make progress. They've all heard it. We've showed them many times. But thank you.
And I want to thank Dooley Kiefer, our vice chair, for starting the meeting off tonight. Thank you very much, Dooley. So I would like to invite John and Marguerite and Mary, whoever would like to come on up. We have 10 minutes now for a presentation about Enfield Energy.
It will be Marguerite.
Great.
Marguerite's going to do the job.
Thank you. Welcome, and thank you for the materials that were in our packet. That was very informative.
Thank you, Martha. Good evening, all. I'm Marguerite Wells. I work with Tom.
You need the microphone?
You need to turn that over.
On the Enfield Energy Project, I also run Mother Plants. We do green roofs out in Enfield, so I'm familiar with some of you in that context. I'm just going to give you, I have 10 minutes to present and 5 minutes for questions, but I think I'd turn that on its head. I only have about 5 minutes of comments just to give you an update on the project and where we're at, and then go to questions. And I got a PowerPoint up here just to show you some pictures of what we're talking about here. You probably know more about wind energy than I have listed here, but just to summarize, obviously wind is increasing as an energy source commercially in the energy mix in the U.S. In other places, there's lots and lots of wind farms going up, and elsewhere in New York State. There is no fuel for wind that you have to buy, so it's a very stable price for wind energy. Obviously, it doesn't produce carbon dioxide or other air pollution. It doesn't require mining, drilling, or transportation of fuel. Obviously, we see the problem with that with the Gulf right now when you're mining, drilling, and transporting fuel. And there is no polluting waste as a result of wind energy either. It also has the potential to bring some jobs and other income to our county, especially to the town of Enfield, which sure could use it. John has been working on the Enfield Energy Project for 7 years now. Mary and I have joined him in the past couple of years. What's proposed is 20 turbines, each of which would be 2.5 megawatts, for a total of 50 megawatts being generated in southwest corner of the town of Enfield. 50 megawatts, which will be produced about a third of the time by the machines, is enough to power all the homes in Tompkins County, as Eric Banford mentioned earlier. It's not the commercial part of the county and not the colleges, but the homes. Here's a couple of pictures of before and after of what it might look like to have some turbines up there. The site is on Black Oak Road, which runs north-south from Route 79 down to the Connecticut Hill Wildlife Management Area. It's the windiest place in the county, and there's already a high-voltage transmission line crossing the site right there, which makes tying into the grid easy and not very expensive. Here's a before. Here's an after. Another before. That's Buck Hill that we're looking at. And an after. This is a summary of where the project is right now. This photo is our meteorological tower. It's got anemometers and temperature gauges at 40 and 50 and 60 meters. It's been taking data for 3.5 years now, continues to do so. We have been working with the town of Enfield, and January a year ago they passed a law regulating commercial wind development in the town. It's a workable law that doesn't prohibit us from going forward with any particularly onerous demands. The site, if you drew a circle around it, is roughly 1,000 acres. Some of it is owned by Enfield Energy, and some of it is leased from local farmers and landowners. Some of the roads are already in place. There are existing firewood roads and such that can be converted into roads that the turbines will be brought in on. Just last month at the Enfield Town Meeting, we submitted, or finally had accepted, our application to the town to get started on this project, which begins the seeker process. And so out to all the interested and involved agencies are letters saying anybody who's got comments on this project or wants to be the lead agency has to contact the town of Enfield and get started on that. But currently the town of Enfield is the lead in the seeker process. We've talked to Lee Shurtleff at Tompkins County Fire and EMS to make sure that our project doesn't interfere with their operations, and it does not. Several years ago, our project came before the Environmental Management Council, and they thought it was a great idea. So that's a letter that we passed around this evening, their letter of support of our project. We are also in the NYISO queue. The NYISO is the folks who manage the grid itself. So we are in process of being approved to join the grid, because that's a long and onerous set of studies to just do that. And what's up and coming for us? We have to begin our EIS this summer. That's based on the assumption that the town will decide that we have a positive declaration of environmental impact, which requires us to do an EIS. That has not actually been legislated yet, but we're assuming that will be the case. So we'll do a bunch of studies on whatever it is they decide to tell us to do, whether it's birds or bats or noise or flicker. There's a bunch of different kinds of studies that are commonly done with wind farms. We assume some of those will be given to us to do. We also have to find a buyer for our power, or multiple buyers. So that could be individuals, or it could be bulk buyers. There's a number of ways that gets done, but we don't have anybody yet who's decided to buy the electricity. We also are looking for a financial partner of one kind or another, either to buy the company or to finance it to get the whole thing done, because it's going to cost between $110 and $120 million to build this thing, and I don't have that in my pocket. And lastly, once all the permitting and financing and every other thing is done, the last thing that remains is to build it. This is a picture of, I believe, Cohocton getting built, but I'm not sure. Anyway, that's what it looks like, big cranes and getting the thing hung up there. And this is the team who we are. John Rancic owns it. He was sitting in the back a minute ago. Oh, there he is. I'm Marguerite Wells, and my partner Lexi Hain works on the project as well. Kay Callahan has helped us with land leasing, and Mary Russell is sitting in the back and is our wise counsel. So that's the sort of basic update. Let me know if you have any questions.
Thank you very much, Marguerite. That's great. Frank.
Can I ask you a question?
Yeah.
Marguerite, can you, not too many of us are running around with $120 million in our pocket either, unless Joe knows something that we don't know. What kind of effort has the company made to put together the financing for this? And assuming that the financing comes together, what's the time span within which it could be built?
The time span, I think I'll work backward in your question there. The time span, if we had the go-ahead today, which we obviously don't have, and there's permitting to be done, but it would take 6 to 9 months to build. So physically, it's not a hard thing to start from today. It's a permitting process thing, and we're banking that we're probably 1 to 2 years out from getting started. Generally, it's good to start in the spring and end in the fall, just for construction's sake. In terms of the effort made to find the financing, John started that slowly years ago, thinking that he could finance it locally, hoping that it could be a locally financed as well as built and owned project. But there has been nobody locally who's been interested or able to come forward and make that happen that we know of yet. So we have been looking farther afield and talking to the usual developers, owners, and financiers of wind farms elsewhere in the country. We've been doing a great deal of effort, really, on that front. One of the things that's been hampering it is the catch-22 of the fact that the best time to build a wind farm is when the economy is doing poorly, because generally materials and everything else are cheaper. And so right now is the time to build the thing. But the other thing that's cheaper is the price of power. And right now the price of power is low enough that it's not economic to build the wind farm. But we're banking on the fact that in a couple of years, price of power will be back up and it would be economic to have the thing already built and generating for that. And so what has been slowing down the financing of it is the price of power currently due to the low economy.
So are you in favor of NYSEG's request for an increase? That's a rhetorical question.
Indeed.
Will?
Yeah. Will and then Peter.
Thank you for a very brief and good presentation. And I would personally just be delighted to see a wind farm locally. I've seen them elsewhere, Western New York. A couple years ago was in Holland and went up and sat right under one of the windmills and was shocked at how quiet and benign it really was. So I really think it's great. What does it mean to be in this queue, the independent system operators queue? Does that, do you have to be a certain position to be able to move forward? Or I saw that on your screen.
It's not an exciting thing to be in the queue. It just means we're number 336. There's 335 projects also in the queue with us and more. What it means is that we have to do a series of studies, each more in-depth and more expensive than the one previous, which look at the engineering details of how to get the power from the particular wind turbines in question into the little section of grid that we will tie into. The grid that we will tie into is a line that runs from Coddington Road over to Montour Falls. It's 115 kilovolts. There's plenty of capacity in that line. NYSEG is the one that manages the line, and they've already said so. But you can't just kind of flip a switch and hook a wire over the top. You have to do a great deal of studies. And so that's what the NYSOQ is about. It's about doing the studies that figure out the detailed engineering about tying in.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Peter.
There was one number in your presentation that really made me sit up with a start. If I did my arithmetic right, 50 megawatts is half a percent of the total wind power in the United States. So this is not a small project. I mean, this is a major project from the point of view of the of wind power in this whole country. Is that correct? I mean, you said it was 50 megawatts, and you said the total production of wind power in this country was 10,000 megawatts. That's half a percent.
Could be. Your math is quicker than mine. But compared to the, I mean, we're not a major project by any means. We're only 20 turbines. There are farms that have 400 turbines. There are farms that have 8. So we're on the smallish, normal size end of the spectrum compared to the size of the other individual farms that get put in. It is a sizable amount of wind power. I'll give you that.
Peter, I think that there's maybe just not as much wind in the country as wind power going in the country as maybe we assume. Maybe that's the denominator that might be surprising.
But then it's hard to believe that a facility with 20, if there are facilities with, I forget the number you said, 800 turbines in there, one with 20, how that could possibly be producing 5%, half a percent of the power. But I just a question that occurred to me while I was listening.
Well, many of the older turbines are a lot smaller, and so you can have wind farms with 500 turbines and they aren't making a lot of juice.
Jim and then Kathy.
Have you worked with Cornell? Have you contacted other counties that have up and running wind farms to see how they proceeded to get themselves established?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've been in touch with the other wind developers and how all this works. We, several years ago, had thought that Cornell would be our primary purchaser of power, and they had at first said they would be. Steve Golding was a guy who worked up there, and he said, yeah, we want all your power, wrote a letter to that effect. Well, Steve Golding's gone, and nobody up there wants the power because they now have this nice cogen plant. And so Cornell had been interested, is not currently interested. We keep recontacting them and say they say that they're not interested. Well, at least the administration, the students are really interested in having us be providing power to Cornell. But we're not particularly holding our breath on that. There's plenty of other people who use power around here, and that would be fine. We're not particular. How other counties get it done, it's done a million different ways. Some people, like up in Tug Hill, a lot of that power is sent down to New York City, and so it's not used by the local counties, and they really have no particular relationship to the wind farm other than the fact that it's in their county.
Is it not true when your power goes to the grid, you have no control over where it goes?
You're absolutely true. Correct, rather. The electrons go where they will, and no one can influence that. It's more a question of who owns the power on paper. New York City can buy Tug Hill power, only nominally so. The electrons will surely go elsewhere along the way.
Kathy.
Thank you. I love the idea of this project. As an electrician, I'm fascinated by different ways of producing energy. And as a facilities person, the kind of issues and questions that come up for me that I'm pretty sure y'all have been faced with but may not have made it into your presentation, there's two aspects of it. One is the maintenance issue. You said in the report that y'all haven't yet decided which company to go with, and I know that sometimes there can be different maintenance issues with different, let's just reduce this here and say different motors require different levels of maintenance. I would hope that there would be some, and I know this is difficult with a new technology, but it's something that as a facilities person I'd be interested in, some record so that potential buyers and possibly the public would have an idea of what they're buying into in terms of maintenance. And the next part that goes with that, and I'm going to just lump this all together, tower work is among, it might even be the most dangerous job in the country right now. And, you know, I'm interested in the notion of these towers being constructed here, but it always worries me thinking about, well, okay, I'm going to digress for a second, but today Hilda Solis issued, well, not today, an interpretation of a regulation that requires safety rules to be presented in the first language of the worker. This is good stuff. This means that if somebody's telling you OSHA rules, they will tell it to you in your language, which is an important thing in our increasingly mobile world. What comes up for me is the notion of unintended consequences with regard to cost of maintenance and cost of having to underwrite the safety requirements with such an onerous facility. And some of these are things that I don't know how to calculate, but I bet y'all do, and I'd love it. I know you might not be able to answer it off the cuff right now, but you talked about the studies having to do with where you said bats, birds, noise, and flicker, which I don't know exactly what flicker is, and frankly all of those other things are of interest to me, but I'm sure I don't know as much about it as y'all do. But is there some possible studies that have been done or that y'all are willing to do with regard to potential maintenance costs of the whatever turbines y'all end up choosing, and safety regulations or best practices with regard to whoever would be chosen? And that's another question: how would the maintenance be expected to be done? Because that could be a huge cost. Think about it. If labor is low right now, but as the economy changes, we hope. Anyway, the cost of labor, especially for these potentially hugely dangerous jobs, would presumably increase. So those are some potential liabilities that I know you all have looked into, and I know that's long-winded, but I just wanted to give you a chance to queue up your answers.
Sure. I bet you I could talk to you about 6 hours, you and I back and forth, about answering your question in depth. But basically, the permitting for the EIS is totally separate from the actual running of the business of a wind farm. And so permitting and noise studies and such like that are unrelated to any studies to do with machine performance. We are not the big dollar player in this picture. Whoever comes in and is the $120 million loaner of this, or owner of this wind farm, is going to be the one who actually decides which brand of turbine to go with. And because it's their dollars, they're going to be picking which machine they think is the most reliable, the least cost, etc. So far, through our permitting process, we had to pick a machine. So we picked the GE 2.5 because GE has the gold standard turbine out there. There are more of them by multiple factors than any other brand of wind turbine out there. And so we basically picked the best thing and the most reliable thing as a something to have a placeholder in the applications, because if nothing else, we could certainly use that machine, and it's a great one. To maintain your warranty, you have to do a certain kind of maintenance anyway, and it has to be done by certified professionals, and it has to be done on a regular basis. So it's not that we could just choose to, oh, I forgot to change the oil this month, oh well. It doesn't work like that. It's not up to us. You hire a maintenance company, they do it. In the same way, well, I can't really come up with a good analogy off the cuff, but basically, yes, maintenance is first and foremost in the operation of these things. There's a lot of new technologies coming out now, improving from the baseline insurance kind of maintenance of them to better predict and prevent downtime, because the better they run, the more money they earn their owners. And so there's a very, very strong market incentive to make them more efficient, more productive, and have fewer failures. So basically, yeah, it's definitely part of the picture, and you and I could talk forever about it.
I appreciate your answer about the GE turbine, because I'm assuming it has a track record that could
yes.
be measured, and maybe for as an example or a baseline, some of that data could be provided with regard to maintenance costs or something relevant to it.
Sure, yeah. I mean,
that's
part
great.
Of the business plan is maintenance cost line items, and you have to budget a certain amount all the time for that, because you have to make sure that you have in the bank enough to keep them all running.
Anyone else? Well, I have a comment and then a question, Marguerite. The reason I was late, I was in Albany lobbying with a number of people about gas drilling, including DEC Commissioner Pete Grannis. While I will tell you that he got defensive and bristly at our first question, went kind of downhill from there, and he said, well, I know you've turned down a wind farm that you know, we had a proposal for a wind farm at Cornell, and the whole community just was against it. I said, well, actually, as a matter of fact, we have a presentation at 5:30 tonight about a new project that we hope will go in. They're working with the town. I don't think he heard me at all, but he was off on his own rant. Anyway, I as others have said, I think this is a great opportunity for us and for the community, and I hope, I wish you all good luck. I want to ask you about your educational center. You've talked to us about these other plans.
So. Yeah, I totally omitted it from the presentation at all. I'm sorry. But one of the fundamental ideas John has always had that I think is pretty cool is to have an educational center up there at the wind farm, presumably a renewable energy center, looking not just at wind, but at solar and biomass and anything else people want to study. We were actually talking to Alan John over at BOCES about this, and he got really excited about being able to turn BOCES programs on and do actual real training on this site. And, you know, because on the West Coast, basically west of the Mississippi, tons of community colleges and other programs like that have wind turbine maintenance programs to train people up. This is a job that people can have, and right now there's nobody locally who's trained to do it, and we'd have to bring out of state or out of town people to come maintain our wind farm. Well, why shouldn't they be local people? And so Alan was getting really excited about BOCES starting up a program relating to this, but that's further down the line than we've gotten so far. But yes, there's a plan to have an educational center up there, kind of like the Science Center, but expanded, hands-on parts of stuff, walking trails around the machines so that you can get right up to them. The first thing that people think is, oh my God, you can be near these machines? And we were talking to the insurance companies who insure wind farms and said, well, what's it going to cost of liability insurance per turbine per year? And the guy said, it's about $500 to insure each turbine per year, which is less than a car. And we said, well, what if we had it open to the public and there are school kids running everywhere? And he said, ooh, that's going to get more expensive, $700 a year per turbine. That's still less than my car insurance. So there's no physical liability having people around these machines, especially not during the regular open season. People are concerned about ice throw, and so probably would close the trails around the machines. They don't actually fling ice off in different directions. There's coatings on the blades so that the ice just drops down at the base of the turbine. But again, you wouldn't have that part open to the public during the ice season anyway. But it'd be a pretty easy thing to have a pretty open facility up there. They have it in Europe all the time, and actually in other parts of the U.S., like in Cleveland, there's a science center that has a turbine right in the middle of the bus turnaround. You can go right up and put your hand on it. So there's no reason we couldn't have the same here.
Thank you very much, John and Mary. I appreciate your coming, and I look forward to talking to you soon.
EnfieldEnergy.com is where to find us and our contact information if you're interested in more information.
Appreciate it. Thanks so much.
Sure.
For my chair's report, I'm going to start with something that should have happened a few meetings ago, but Nathan was sick. So, Nathan, we have your certificate of recognition for 5 years of service on the county legislature.
Hello.
So,
right.
Come on up.
Nice.
Really?
Yeah.
Cool.
Congratulations.
Thank you very
much. So as I said, I was in Albany today together with Tony Ingrafia, engineer from Cornell, Bob Howarth, environmental biologist from Cornell, Ed Marks, whom I think you know, and Helen Slotcha, environmental attorney. Last week we went almost the same crew, but with Don Barber. And so we think how to summarize. I handed Speaker Silver a letter. Frank, I didn't get a chance to really say anything about it. It was a flyby in a hallway, kind of, but he really listened. It was, I think, Speaker Silver came out last week when the DEC announced the additional requirements for site-specific EIS evaluations for the New York City and Syracuse watersheds. Sheldon Silver came out, and he hasn't made, as far as I can tell, any other public statement. He came out and said that was not appropriate, that all of New York State should be treated the same, and that, in fact, New York should not move forward until the EPA study on hydrofracking has been finished. So we were able to thank him for that statement. And then he said, well, actually,
I wouldn't say this, you know, out loud, but I actually care more about the people living near the hydrofracking operations than necessarily the watershed. So I think he's been very quietly kind of listening to a lot of this debate, a lot of education. I think Barbara Liffen has had a tremendous influence on him. She was the one who arranged this meeting. So shout out to Barbara on that. As I said, we saw Pete Granis, along with Deputy Commissioner Stuart Gruskin and Val Washington, Deputy Commissioner. Very defensive. No, they would not say what kind of a timeline there is. They would not say they are still apparently moving towards issuing a final SGEIS without a comment period. Without an additional comment period or formal rulemaking. They did say that they are in close touch with regulators in Pennsylvania, which I would think would make them want to run the other way, but it doesn't seem that way. They seem convinced that New York is going to do it better than everybody else. So that felt frustrating. We had a good meeting with Senator Arbertine's staff. Daryl Arbertine is senator, chair of the Agriculture Committee. We saw him in the hallway like that, but had 45 minutes with three staffers who were very interested, especially the executive director the director of the Rural Resources Commission, asked some very good questions. And the fourth visit was with John Howard in the Attorney General's office. Yes, Carol, you were with us last time when we met with him. He's Deputy Chief of Staff. He asked a lot of good questions. He read the material we left him last time, so the discussion continues. So I feel strongly that it's important that we do this and we keep doing it. A couple of us went to the Democratic World Conference over the weekend, a political event, but there were a number of leaders there, and we had some of those similar conversations. We saw Senator Thompson last week. He's chair of the Environmental Conservation Committee in the Senate, and he was taking a second group of legislators to Dimock, Pennsylvania, and to see a Chesapeake drill site. I think Ed was calling it the Disneyland site of gas drilling, so they've got a site that they've polished up. So, sorry if I'm editorializing here, but so the legislature is absolutely paying attention. There's a number of bills that are pending. There's some that are encouraging that want to subsidize the gas companies. That we want to encourage them to come to New York, and so we should offer subsidies to them. And the other side, there's a at least one bill that is asking for a moratorium until the EPA study is finished. So it's a full range. And I think the feelings are not necessarily one party or the other. I think they're sort of cross party lines, basically. So I think the educational effort that we've been making and citizens have been, you know, doing for us has been critical, and we need to continue. So that's my report, unless there are any questions on that. Nathan.
Martha, Governor Rendell in Pennsylvania has proposed a tax on Marcellus Shale drilling. Did anybody talk about, well, obviously right now we're talking about opposing a lot of drilling, but if it happened, did anybody say, well, we would tax it and hopefully tax the heck out of it?
Right now there's no severance tax in Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. I understand that the average in other states is 7-8%. So the fact that Pennsylvania went ahead without any is interesting, and
I think
so now he's
going to get 10% tax.
Now he's thought about it, I guess, and they also keep issuing additional regulations. There are 19 pages of new regulations being promulgated in Pennsylvania just on, I can't remember, one particular aspect of the process. Governor Patterson has a 3% severance tax in his proposed budget, but it wouldn't. He doesn't show revenue until I think the year after next on this. So 3 is low. Yeah. You know, if the average is 7-8, 3 is certainly low. But I don't know what's going to happen in Pennsylvania. Frank?
Martha, a question and a comment. Did you say no one has proposed a severance tax in New York?
Governor Patterson has a 3% tax in his proposed budget.
In his proposed budget.
Right. Okay. So whenever drilling would begin, that there would be a 3% tax.
While you were traveling to Albany this morning, Barbara Lifton was on WHCU and Senator Seward was on as well. Seward had attended with other senators that trip to PA.
So did Barbara.
And he said that they saw the good, the bad, and the ugly. So it was an array of items. So
it's very important that people do that. I understand Senator Nozzolio has an excellent statement asking for the state to demand the industry's private proprietary information that the regulators need to have, like seismic and other information, that it should be available to the regulators, if not to the public. That's among the things that he's stood for. So, and I guess, Joe, you told me that there's an article about that Chesapeake has now decided they're going to start running tours because they want to change right. everybody's perception about gas drilling?
That's right.
Okay. Jim?
Nothing.
Okay. Anybody else? Thank you very much. County Administrator's Report.
Thank you, Martha. I have a few items on my list tonight. And whenever I do these reports, I try to give you a sense of what we've done since our last meeting. And I think all of you would understand that since the last meeting, much of the work in my office has been preparing for the kickoff of the budget process that actually begins tonight. And I'd like to recognize Norma Jane and the work that she's done to get our budget in a condition very early in this year so that we can begin to make reasoned decisions about a budget that's going to be a very difficult budget, as we all know, to deal with over the course of this year. We begin a process tonight that will end, I think it's November 15th, so it's a long journey we'll follow, but again, over the past couple of weeks, there's been a fair amount of time trying to look ahead, try to project where our numbers are going to go, and provide you good information that will allow you to make some decisions tonight about levy goals. As a part of our budget process, and this is under the heading of fair warning to many of you, there was a group that came together after the legislative department had retreat last time to work on our more programmatic approach to decision making. I think we may want to do one more meeting with that group. I think there were about 15 people all together, half legislators, half department heads, to kind of polish that up, finish it up, spend a little time focusing on criteria that might be applied as we try to assess the impact of our programs. So as soon as I can get my head above water to look at calendars, I hope to bring us together again for one fairly short meeting to kind of wrap things up on that front. Updates, the issue that I've been updating you on now for a long, long time, the consortium, we're still not there. The unions did meet yesterday to talk about some of their concerns and their hopes regarding representation on the board. I know that they've communicated with Don Barber on a couple of fronts. First, some clarifications on the advisory committee, which is really, I think, the most important development that's happened over the past 6 months in terms of being able to look at all potential changes in benefit plans and having a very open process of looking at that. They want some clarifications in that, and I think that's going to be something very easy to do. And again, they're beginning to talk about numbers that they would hope to have on the board, and without revealing any confidences, it's more than one, which is what's currently in the draft plan. So those conversations will begin to kick off with the consortium very soon. With respect to the other issue there, reserves, we're still looking for ways to bridge a $2 million gap in the reserves for the consortium. Don Barber, David Squires, and I have begun to talk again about a financing approach, a letter of credit approach that we may want to pursue with banks, so we're beginning to flesh that out too. So stay tuned for that, and I'll keep you posted as developments occur there, and hopefully we'll begin to be able to close the gaps that have separated us from getting the construction going. The big sale is working its way through committees. I think we go to F&I soon and hope to bring the big sale to the hospital, to the legislature at its next meeting. The last item on my list, Sheriff Meskel and I went to Public Safety yesterday to advise Public Safety Committee of an invitation that we received from the federal government to keep an application, a grant application that we had submitted last fall under the COPS program, which is the community-oriented policing program. You may recall that last year, I think it was late summer or fall, we submitted a grant application to have federal dollars pay for an additional up to 3 deputy sheriffs. The basis of that grant was for 3 years, the federal government picks up most of the cost. In the fourth year, the county picks up the cost of those deputies. And at that point, we can decide whether we want to keep our roster at that level. As you may recall, the understanding and agreement at that time to submit the grant was that the sheriff would, in turn, find ways to save between $80,000 and $90,000 a year in overtime costs, which at the end of that four-year line would be adequate to cover most of the cost that the county would bear over that four-year period, that fourth-year cost. So that basic premise is still there. We have been invited by the federal government to basically keep our application in play into round two of funding. Round one came and went. We were not awarded any grant money. Those that didn't make it in round one have been invited to keep their applications alive in round two. So basically with the same set of ground rules in place that existed last time, including overtime commitments, much of which has already been achieved by the sheriff, we did advise public safety that we wanted to get a sense of the committee, so whether that's okay to keep that active. The committee's response was positive. So I just wanted to inform the legislature, the full legislature as well, that that's our proposal is to keep that application alive in Washington through round two. I think that's it. If anyone has any questions of me, I'm certainly taking.
Joe, I'm sorry. I have two questions, but yes. The last thing that you reported on with Sheriff Meskel, can you say again what that application, is there a title to that application?
It's called COPS, C-O-P-S, and it stands for Community Oriented Policing, I think it's Services. It's a federal plan that, again, provides federal funding for additional police officers on the street. The deal is the feds pay the first 3 years, most of it, and then the locality pays for the full cost of those officers in the final year of the arrangement.
The two I have for you, any update on the broadband application with Google?
I don't. I don't think there is anything new to report on that, Frank.
The other is all of us were treated to a letter from Excellus, those of us that and county employees, both retirees and actives, that are part of the health plan. And I've had several calls, I think you probably have too, that basically says the existing health plan is going to explode on October 1st. And Brooks sent out a blurb that said, don't panic, we'll still have health coverage. But there was no description of what's going to happen and what is going to be included. My question to Brooke was, did we participate in the decision to discontinue the present plan? And B, when will we have some idea so we could tell our employees and people that have been calling us what they can expect in coverage? Do you have any idea what's happening?
I do. And I wouldn't characterize it as exploding. The plan is going from basically a system of local plans. So Excellus Blue Cross has a plan for the Tompkins County area that we buy into right now. And they may have another plan for Schuyler County and another plan. They're very, very similar. Basically variations on an overall theme. But administratively, to Excellus Blue Cross, every time there's a change dictated by the state insurance department, for example, as small as it may be, administratively it's painful to have to go through each of those scores of different plans and make those changes. So Excellus has made a corporate decision to fold all those onto a common platform called Classic Blue. And again, since everything was basically a variation on a theme to begin with, the changes, the actual changes in the plan in making that migration are very, very small, perhaps even imperceptible. We have sat with Excellus to look at where those changes might affect our plan. In some cases, we've been able to basically option a little tweak in the basic plan to make it even closer to what we currently offer to our employees than we would in the basic plan. The cost is relatively neutral. So we have worked with Excellus to make sure that it's as seamless as possible. However, we don't want to represent that it will be to the penny exact. I think we learned a lesson with conversion on a drug plan to be careful about what we represent. But I think you will find the changes are minute. Blue Cross will now take the ball. We wanted to give our employees and retirees a good notice that they should expect some letters to begin coming from Excellus Blue Cross to advise them of this change. We didn't want just a cold call to our people. So that's what that letter was about. And that information will begin to flow very quickly now from Blue Cross. I'd just like to make an editorial point on this change. I think one of the selling points for the consortium has been, through this advisory committee especially, there won't be any imposed changes in this plan. That when change has to happen, maybe there are changes that are mandated by the insurance department or some other outside source, absolutely transparent, come through a committee, labor representation, management representation at both a committee and a board level. Everything happens in a very transparent way with lots of advance notice. Sometimes, under our current plan, things can happen that corporate decisions get made and are communicated to us. And again, in terms of how we look at the benefits of the consortium compared to the current plan, one benefit is there is the light of day. Labor is involved in the review as well as management. And we can make decisions about whether this is the right kind of change for our community or not. So that's a very long answer to a very short question, but again, information will begin to flow now from Excellus Blue Cross for employees. The change will not happen until October.
So the reason I follow up, the reason that I ask is that there, some of the employees are scratching their heads wondering what's happening, and some retirees are in the same boat too.
Jim?
Well, my answer to Frank, the Ithaca City School District has the same plan we have. They've gotten the same letter. You needed to look closely at the letter and say and believe that nothing was going to change until the plan was actually changed. The name has been changed. Some of the things have been changed about it that Joe has talked about. The City School District is trying to answer the same kinds of questions. The answers aren't there yet, but I think people have to understand. They have to believe what we send them, and because we do not send them deceptive material.
I'm from the government. I'm here to help you.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Joe. I meant to say also that I am. I want to thank Joe for helping me with a letter to Speaker Silver, and which I did drop off. I will send everybody a copy of that. And I understand that Chuck Bartosz, the Clarity Connect's proposal on broadband, he's resubmitting that. There's a second round in for ARRA funding, and he is putting that back in. So that's still in the game. Carol.
Yeah, I have a question related to telecommunications, not who and how it's funded, which companies will own the lines. I noticed that the issue of regard of what packets of information need to be carried on those lines is back in the national discussion. An issue known by those who support totally open rules for having to carry all kinds of information, call it net neutrality, it may be called by other names. The question I have is, because that's in the public eye and because decisions will have to be made about that, I think that is something that will affect what we do at the county, particularly related to Mike's point about the requirement that we distribute information about what we do as a county. Should the decision go the other way, whatever company owns those lines could be telling us, we won't carry your information. We'll carry the information of the private companies, we'll carry information by those we agree with, but we're not required to carry any particular type of information.
Carol,
I want to know is whether you or your staff could look into whether other localities need to be weighing in on this or have weighed in on this issue, and whether it's something we ought to consider.
If you'd like to call, and we'll involve Paula in that conversation and follow up on this.
Okay, County Attorney Jonathan.
I have no report.
Thank you. Is there anybody going to speak for David, or are we all? No report from
nobody
the finance director. Nobody can speak for David.
I'm happy he's not here. That means there's no bad news this week.
Okay.
It's so bad he can't bring himself to be here.
All right. Thank you.
Maybe he doesn't want to be here for that resolution that may be added to the agenda.
So that was my next question. So are there any resolutions to be added to or withdrawn from the agenda? Jim Dennis.
Yes, I'd like to I'd like to add Resolution C. It's on your desk. It was in your red folder. It's the establishment of the 2011 County Financial Goal, and I would move that.
Thank you. There's a second from Mike. Okay. We need 10 votes to add it. All in favor of adding it? Do you want to speak, Jen?
I'm sorry?
Discussion. Usually we just vote on adding it. Just to add it. We'll have discussion.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Right.
I would like to add it to the agenda, not on the agenda.
Duly.
Is Jim talking about a version that has actual numbers in it?
Yeah.
Is that what he's adding? Because what we have now doesn't have any.
We had a meeting prior to the regular meeting, and there is a number 5 in it, and in the percent line.
And that's what you'd be adding, no?
That should be added.
Okay. Kathy.
I'd just like, for the record, a clarification of why this didn't make it into the packet in time to be on the agenda, as is our practice.
Jim?
We had a substitute resolution, and I took one off, put the other one on. That's why it was not there.
All right.
I'm sorry.
There was one, and I removed one, and we added the one that you're looking at, the reviewed resolution, revised.
There wasn't anything in my agenda packet.
Well, we had a retreat a week ago, and the coming out of the retreat, we.
There was no action out of the retreat. It was
right.
Discussion, so.
We could have put sort of the skeleton, the resolution into the packet without a number, which maybe we've done in the past.
Madam Chair,
yes.
This is point of order. This is just to add it to the agenda.
That's
We shouldn't be discussing the resolution.
I was just asking a question, and I just have a follow-up question. Given the discussion we had at the previous meeting, this is not our usual practice, and this is something that ordinarily we wouldn't do, and in the past we haven't done. Is that correct?
We add resolutions to the agenda all the time.
In terms of the tax levy resolution, it's usually on the agenda ahead of time.
Is there any other discussion? All in favor of adding this to the agenda, we need 10 votes to add it. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Any opposed? 1 opposed. All right. Anything to be withdrawn or anything else to be added?
Okay, the consent agenda is resolutions and appointments to be voted on as a group unless anyone requests that they be pulled off for separate discussion. We have an appointment for Brian Wilbur to the Emergency Communications Review and Oversight Committee, and Resolution A. Okay, that would be the whole consent agenda. So, do you have a motion on the one item on the consent agenda?
Move it.
Carol? Frank moves it.
I just want to take that off, just for a brief point.
The appointment?
Yes.
Okay, fine. So we have no consent agenda. All right. Jim?
As soon as we decide what's going to be on the consent agenda, could I ask your permission to move this item that I just put on the agenda to the next item following the consent agenda?
There's no consent agenda.
He wants his resolution.
I understand that.
Understood.
But, you know, may we be next?
Yeah, Resolution A is probably the next one.
Mike?
I just want to point out we have a staff person representing Resolution A, so maybe we ought to move that along to it.
Okay. Thank you all for your advice. Let us, the Planning Committee is the first item, and that is not Resolution A.
So the answer is no.
I'm sorry?
The answer is no.
So could you just reorder the...
All right, I'll tell you what. Let's just do Resolution A. I agree. Jay can go home. This is Gio. Mike?
Happy to move Resolution A, refund of taxes, Village of Lansing, tax parcel 45.1-1-55.14. And this was approved by the Government Operations Committee at the special meeting right before this board.
Thank you. In less than seconds. And Mike, do you want to speak about this?
Yeah, I do. The reason I took it off consent was that the committee asked particularly that there be an explanatory note added to this resolution. To the effect that the property in question is the county's health department building, and the reason that the taxes were paid and was that there had to be research done because of the Cornell ground lease provisions, that we had to double check that we were tax exempt for that, and the opinion of council is that we are.
This is the new building, Brown Road.
The new building on Brown Road.
Any other questions or comments? Ready to vote. All in favor of Resolution A, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Any opposed? That's unanimous. Thank you. Thank you, Jay. All right. Jim, why don't you start with your report?
All right. Let me try this one more time. This establishment of the 2011 county financial goal. And the last resolve talks about... the fact that we are recommending, the committee is recommending that the maximum tax levy increase is 5% as a guideline to the county administrator to prepare the 2011 budget. I would move that.
Okay, is there a second? Nathan seconds. Is there a discussion? Frank.
My recollection is normally we have a dollar amount in there, don't we, as to what that...
No.
Is this the one that we have something, some reference?
That will come next. Okay. So next month you'll have the dollar signs and spending targets.
Is this the resolution, though, that the range was as low as zero and as high as 10.2?
Yes.
And you'll see in the second, whereas that a maintenance of effort budget would require a 10.2% tax levy increase.
Yeah, since we weren't reading it, I want thanks for bringing that out. I know there was some discussion at the retreat for vehement support for the 10.2.
That's right. And that support was from...
There was also support for zero.
Jim and then Peter.
To spare you, we have had this discussion, and I did not want to elucidate on any of the things that are in the agenda. It's a simple guideline. We're telling the county administrator to go out and try to prepare a budget with that number in it, and that's what I would like to see coming out of this potential vote. We could certainly rehash the retreat, but I would beg you not to do that.
Peter?
Yeah, if it's in order, I'd like to move an amendment to this motion.
Certainly.
That I would move that the target be 0% increase, and if there's a second, I'd like to speak to that.
Is there a second? Pat seconds that. Peter?
We all know these are hard times. They're hard times for people who are working for the county. They're hard times for the people that are receiving the services of the county, and they're hard times for people who are paying for paying for those services, namely the taxpayers. It's hard to put numbers on what is a reasonable tax increase. And myself, I think that the way that we should look at least the target for a tax increase, and by target, I mean just that, target. Namely, it's not an absolute as far as I'm concerned, but the target that we should try for is to have a tax increase that's no more than the cost of living. Why do I say that? The reason I say that is that if one has a tax increase that's greater than the cost of living for a long time, it becomes untenable. That I think a good rule of thumb is that while there are some ups and downs over the long run, the tax increase should be no greater than the cost of living, because people's ability to pay in general raises goes up no higher, and in recent times for most people actually less than the cost of living increase. Now, in looking at this, in preparing for this resolution, or preparing for the budget retreat, I look back a couple of years to see what the cost of living increase had been over the last 3 years and what the tax increase that we have done in two previous years was. And it turns out that over the past 3 years, the cost of living increase has increased by 7%. It's 7% higher now than it was 3 years ago. Last year, our increase in the levy was 4%. And the year before, our increase in the levy was 3% in round numbers. Therefore, if we do nothing this year, if we do not increase the levy at all, then in fact the levy over the past 3 years would be increased over the past 3 years would be 7%, which is exactly equal to the cost of living increase over the past 3 years. And I believe that equality is the one that should govern our goal. Now, this is not to say that the goal is an absolute number to be that must be obeyed. It's not rigid. But in preparing the budget, I believe that the county administrator should try as hard as he can to make sure that the tax levy increase does not increase faster than the cost of living. So, that's it, pure and simple. And that's my motion.
I think so. Jim next, and then Pat.
I'm going to pass. I will let others.
Pat, and then Nathan.
I'd just like to say that I do agree with what the comments that Peter has made. And also, in addition to that, I think we've stated very clearly here that this is a guideline. We've discussed the fact that it's a guideline. However, once we set this, it seems very unlikely to me that there will be any real pressure from any place to do any less than 5%. I can see where during the budget process that there can be pressure to raise this 5%, but I think it's highly unlikely, especially given that we have a 10.2%, we would need a 10.2% increase as a maintenance of effort budget, that there would be any real look at what might be necessary to make this less than 5%. And it just feels to me, in this kind of an economy, when we have as many people as we do, as Peter said, whose ability to pay is not rising at the same rate that their taxes are increasing, that we should be obligated to make every effort to keep this as low as possible. And for me, as low as possible is way below 5%.
Nathan?
I just wanted to give some context here. In 2009, the tax levy that for the 2009 budget, I should say, the goal that we set was 3%, and we hit and we got 2.99%, right? And in 2010, I think our goal was 3%, and we got to about 4%. Right? Yeah, and that looks pretty good, and especially since we were dealing with maintenance of effort budgets close to 10% each of those years, it looked like we were very disciplined, and we cut back hard, and we did cut back, especially last year, quite considerably. But even so, during those 2 years, in 2009, we used $3.4 million of fund balance, which is cash. We used that cash, and still had a couple million left in our reserves. In 2010, we used $2.24 million in cash, basically, to cushion the levy as well. And so what that did is that artificially lowered the tax levy. All right. Well, it didn't artificially lower the tax levy, but it made it look like we were incredibly disciplined. When really, we just used a lot of cash, and we got to a position where we are right now looking at... It's basically a 1.15, but there's also, I know there's $1 million placeholder, Joe, right now for the mortgage recording tax. But still, that's only $1 million over the 5% that we should have to maintain our bond rating. So we are dangerously close. And so the reason why I'm talking about this is that having a 5% goal seems like a lot right now. But it's a 5% goal given that we don't have any cash to work with like we did before. We can't use the equivalent of 8.5% worth of cash like we did in 2009. It's just not possible. It's just not there. And so really, this 5% goal is incredibly ambitious because there is no wiggle room. And there has been wiggle room in the past. That's why I caution us with this 0% type of language. 5% is actually quite terrific for the organization, and I mean the terror form of terrific, right? In the sense that that I believe that it is a strong, stringent goal that requires us to have incredible amounts of fiscal discipline, and we will have to make tough choices because we have no other choice given our cash position. So I just wanted to give that background.
All right, let me hear Frank, then Mike, then Pam, then Will.
Thanks for saying that, Nathan. I'm going to ask Joe at some point to let us know what a 0% and what a 5% levy translates to and what would have to be cut dollar-wise. My recollection is that the 5% is about a $2.5 million cut.
It's about $2 million.
About $2 million. What is zero?
$3.9 million.
That's what we would have to trim out of the 2011 right. budget.
And that's on a base, Frank, of about 38. Remember, there are some of our costs that you really can't cut. You can't cut Medicaid. You can't cut debt service. So there are a number of costs that we can't cut. So that $3.9 million would have to be found in a group of programs and services that total about $38 million. So we would have to cut about 10% of discretionary and mandated responsibility kind of spending.
So the effect could be severely devastating. The process, as I recall, this is a guideline, and we do tweak things as we go through it. And with all due respect to legislators who will be going through this with us for the first time anyway, we do a lot of talking during this process. And we have ups and downs, and you can add amendments and changes and whatnot and get passionate over programs and dispassionate over some. But all this is a place from which to begin. I mean, if you want to get tougher and go from five, if assuming this passes at five, and it may not, going down to zero. The amendment is for zero, as I understand it. But the concern, and I believe me, I more than anybody else, or at least as much as anybody else, appreciates the effect on our taxpayers, but the offside of that is we may be devastating them even more by coming up with the horrific cuts to some of the services the way you just described them, and only the process is going to reveal that. So I would argue not to support the 0%. I know that's a surprise, but that's my position. Thank you.
Thank you, Frank. Mike?
I can't support a 5% goal. I think it's just too high. And I think that with the pain that people are experiencing in the real property tax, we know where the schools are, we know where the city is, where the towns and villages are. They're at the property tax too. Everybody goes to that as their final and ultimate budget balancer. We've had 0% goals before, and we've worked through that. We at least migrate, as the past couple of years has shown, at least a percent over the goal. Whether that's good or bad, I don't know. But if we set a 5% goal now, then we could expect probably to migrate to 6. I think 6 is much too high. I think that it will be painful for our departments and for our customers and residents to see this cut. But look, open the newspaper, turn on the television, listen to what's going on at the state level. And remember, we're the poor relation of the state. We have to kind of do what we're told. Joe mentioned Medicaid, for example. We have to be back to basics. We have to do just those things that we have to do because we don't have the money to pay for more. And so I will vote for the 0% increase, and I will not be able to vote for 5% as a goal.
Pam, Will, Jim, and I'm putting myself in, and what, Kathy, Leslin. Kathy, Leslin, Peter, Dooley. So, Pam.
I cannot support a 0%. I think that is taking us too far afield, and I'm not sure that I agree that trying to even out the rate increase to agree with the CPI makes sense, because what we need each year in relationship to the CPI changes with the CPI. But I can't possibly support 5% either. I do not think that we have ever started with a goal and gone down. We have started with a goal and stayed very close to it, but generally we have gone up some. And so I think starting at 5% will inevitably lead us more towards 6%, and that's too much. I have constituents who are selling their houses who can't pay the taxes anymore. And these are people who live in the city, and admittedly that the city taxes are particularly onerous, but it's the accumulative effect of all of these taxes. And I don't know, somewhere in here we have to strike a balance between the people who need our services and the people who have to pay for the services, but I think it's lower than 5%. I also, the basic problem for me is that what I see the state government and I see the federal government, and what their policies are doing is they're basically lowering our standard of living by taking away monies that we used to get from them to support our needs in our county, and imposing unfunded mandates, forcing us to pay for part of the bill for Medicaid. These are the things that are really happening to us and are putting us in the untenable position where the last stop on the railroad line of funding, and we are the ones who have to present the bad news. And I think that there's a limit to what we can do. I mean, we We just can't do it as a county. You know, that the property tax is an onerous, I do not like that way of taxing people, and particularly in this situation where it's become the major way that we're funding things. And we cannot do this. We cannot continue to raise the taxes of all our residents. Maybe a little bit a year, but that's a little bit for the county, a little bit for the city or the towns, and usually a lot for the school districts, but all of it ends up being too much. And I really hope that we will consider going below this 5% as our target.
I've got Will, Jim, myself, and then keep going.
Well, I actually agree with a lot of what Pam said. I think it's tragic that we are forced into this position. I, however, start from the premise that what we are delivering to our citizens is vitally important, and that we need to do more than just the minimum, that we are truly the last refuge in terms of basic community services, whether it's keeping our roads safe enough to drive on, or our sheriff being able to respond in a decent time, to having a library that functions and can be a place where people can go and use computers when they can't afford to have their own service at home. I would be in favor of a maintenance of effort budget, which was over 10%. I literally feel that I could just, in my own mind, justify that and argue that persuasively to my neighbors, because I know how important that is. I also know that I have no chance of persuading my colleagues on the board. So in that sense, the 5% really, truly was a compromise from my mind. And the pain that we would be inflicting on our constituents to a 0% is unfathomable in terms of, when we see what cuts we'll have to do, I think we would all very quickly be very, very, very upset. So I urge us to stick with the 5%, and that's the way I would be voting.
Jim?
You all know this. 20% of the property tax burden in the county, we are 20% of the burden. Everyone else gets the other 80%. We have more to do by state mandate than any other municipality. Run it through your head. Look at the city. What do they need to do? What are they willing to drop? Nothing that you can see. Last year, we started with 3, we ended up at 4. We actually spent less money in the 2010 budget than we did the prior year, and we added $380,000 to the budget. The 5%, that a zero would be devastating. The number of people, we would have to move to a bigger room. The number of people who would be behind us would be legendary, who would come in, because we would have to eliminate the kinds of things that all of you profess to many times in meetings, talk about the most needy people. And if you want to run with the zero levy increase, those are the people that are going to be affected, and some of our employees. So please vote against zero. Please try to support 5. When I hear it may go up, it may go down, we have a history in this county of doing a lot of ways, but 5 is a legitimate number, I believe, a legitimate number for the county administrator to start out with. And anything, a zero would be just, I don't want to hear the screams.
Jim, you said, let me just for clarification, you said our budget last year, we actually spent less money than the year before.
And we increased over our goal 1%. We started with a 3, we ended up at a 3.9 and change, and we actually spent less money in our 2010 budget. Our bottom line number was less than what we had for our final budget in 2009.
We made
cuts. As you all remember, there were some painful cuts. We lost employees. A bunch of different things happened to get to that point.
Right, I think we lost 20 employees. My turn now. I would point out that we had this retreat where we went through a lot of information, and the public is able to ask and call administration and get the PowerPoint that Joe and Norma put together. That's available. I'm not sure if it's on our website, but it's certainly available if people call. It was a public meeting, so we had a lot of this background information as well as a lot of this discussion. I would just point that out. The mother of all mandates, if we thought Medicaid was bad, for the next 3 or 4 years, the pension costs are going to rise incredibly. It's for every municipality, every school district, every town, anybody who's in the state retirement system, with no control by us, with no, you know, nothing we can do about it. It will go from 11.5% of payroll to 16.5% of payroll. Now, you might think, well, that's 5%. No, that's almost 50%. It's a 5% increase, which is almost half of 11. So that's a 50% increase in a very large bill. So these are not normal times. Every county is in this situation. It is a structural problem caused in many ways by the recession. And unfortunately, because it's cyclical, we are counter-cyclical. When the economy goes down, the demands on our services increase. So that's why I will be voting against the zero and for the five. I've got Kathy Leslin, Peter Dooley.
Thank you. I'm not going to support this amendment to lower the number to 0%, and I'll explain why. It's not that I think it would be impossible to achieve, and it's not that I think it would be terribly unpopular or that I couldn't withstand the outcry from the public. I've proposed 0% in the past myself, and in fact, I could just as easily take the tactic that Will is taking and say, you know, why don't we go to 15% and try and fund everything we can, because these are really hard times. I'm looking at 2 to 3% is what I'll support. And for me, some people have talked about balance. If I could, we've shown fiscal prudence in the past, and in the recent past, that's actually part of why, relative to other counties, our record over the past 4 to 5 years of being really rigorous in our budgets and in fact using some of our cash reserves, I think, in a wise way, has put us in the position, and I think it's an enviable one. As hard as things are, it's an enviable one of not necessarily having to panic and slash employees. We do need services, and at a time like this, we need services more than ever. I think 2 to 3% will make us really look hard, and I think it will make us keep to our promises, and it's consistent with the fiscal rigor that we've displayed in past years. I agree with what some have said, that 5% lends itself to 6%. Our record shows that. 2 to 3% is where I'll be, so I won't be supporting this resolution because I think the times call for more expenditure than a 0% budget would allow us.
Thank you, Kathy. Leslin?
So in good conscience, I too cannot support a 0% budget. Over the years, I'm pretty consistent about where we are and what it's going to be, and I wouldn't vote necessarily for a budget that goes beyond what we have set as our goal. Last year, I know how difficult it was, and it still is very difficult to think about or deal with the people who we ended up having to lay off employees. And if I think of some of the people who then have to turn around and seek services, and some of the very mandated costs we're talking about is now going to go even higher because at least one family of four who I know whose parent was laid off is there. So I can't reasonably support a 0% budget at all. This is really hard, and I dislike budget time. I really do. So I'll just put it out there. So when I'm grumpy and cranky, you know why. But when we start to say things like, we just have to do what
are the mandated things we have to do. That troubles me, because we're looking at the very people who really need some of the services we offer that are not mandated by any means, are the ones who are going to suffer even more and are going to drive costs on another end for us. And then we face the same thing next year, saying, how did this cost go through the roof this much? So we have to be a little bit more reasonable in our thinking, at least I do. And where can I reasonably come out and support? 5% is a big number for me to swallow, a really huge number for me to swallow. And I know I'm going to hear it from my constituents. Living in the city of Ithaca, like you alluded to, Pam, is no easy task, because that triple tax plus all the fees that you end up paying for everything, that's now even more, really puts you in a bad place. I know it. I live it. I feel it. It burns. Hurts. But I also know that I can't support the other end, which is a 10% or even go beyond 5. So I'm willing to say, I'm going to say it out loud, yes, that I will support a 5% tax levy increase and no more. So I'll put it out there like that. If we're going to start creeping beyond that, that's not going to happen for me, and I can't support your amendment, Peter. Although I appreciate the sentiment behind it, I just can't do a 0% budget. It's not fair to the folks who rely on us for services out there, and to our employees, who we probably are going to have to look at laying more of them off. Not fair.
Thank you, Liz. And Peter.
Yeah, a number of years ago, I played in a play by the Dryden Footlighters. I was Ebenezer Scrooge in A Christmas Carol. I find myself characterized as the character that I played. One is caught between a rock and a hard place. Let me tell you how I got to this place. I campaigned very vigorously for this position, and I walked up and down streets and knocked on people's doors, and I always started by saying, I'd like to talk to you about what you think about county government. What is it you want? I'm running for this office, and I'd like to know what you want me to do. And I got back a bunch of different answers, but the answer I got back most was, I want you to keep down taxes. I want you to lower taxes. Taxes are too much. I can't pay these taxes anymore. All you do is increase the taxes. And I know that, you know, some people go campaign, they say, I promise I will lower the taxes by something or else. But I couldn't say that. And what I said to these people is, I will not promise you that I won't vote for a tax increase, but what I will promise you is that if I vote for a tax increase, I will come back and be able to stand in front of you and tell you why I did that. But I think that the attempt should be not to do that. So I've heard a lot of stories about the pain that it will cause, but I can't take that as a legislator at face value. I have to see that pain. I have to see that pain and make it and be influenced by that pain to the degree that I will say to a constituent who said, you came and told me you're going to keep down taxes, I'll say, well, here's why I didn't. Because what was going to happen was that, for instance, at the library, just to pick up one that Will said, at the library, now that the internet access that's given to people who can't afford to do it on themselves will be gone. I think that would be inexcusable. That would make me go away from a 0% increase. But frankly, Will, I don't know that that's what's going to happen. I don't know what it means to get a 10%, to get a 0% tax levy, exactly what the pain will be, program by program. And I feel that we should all have that experience before agreeing, before saying casually 5% isn't so much, or it's only $70 in a bill on a so-and-so $1,000 house or something like that. I think that we should all experience in some detail what it means to get a 0% budget increase. Because I think if it is not as bad as you think, then it is our obligation to the people who want us to hold down the tax rate to do just that. So in no sense am I saying that none of the things you've said are not true. But on the other hand, I personally don't know it. I haven't seen what's going to happen if we do that. So I offer this in the following, with the following in mind, that I would like to see from the county administrator what a zero tax increase means. And then, seeing that, I think that we ought to decide on which ones of these cuts do we think are not possible to bear. That's it. So it's the question of making sure that when we do increase the tax increase, if that is necessary, that we're able to face the people that want us to keep it at zero and tell them exactly why it is that we haven't done that, not by something that we guessed might have happened, by something that we saw that did happen. So that's the reason for me to proposing this.
Thank you, Peter. Dooley. And then Carol.
Well, Peter, you have the luxury of taking a theoretical approach to this because you haven't gone through the agony of our budget process before. And so you're lucky in that sense. I want to tell everybody that those of us who've been on the legislature a long time have gone through periods where the legislature cut budgets, didn't just raise things. And this number that is in the resolution tonight, 5%, is a tool for Joe to use. It's too early in the year for us to know whether that should be our legislative goal in the fall or not. But it's something that will allow Joe to work with departments and come back with a proposal, with a recommendation that would meet that particular guideline. However, he will have to apply his own judgment as to what is important and what isn't important. And that's really our job. When you get his recommendation, you will have enough information about programs. And in fact, I think you'll have it at program committees during the summer that you can get a sense of what reaching 0% would mean. So you don't have to force us all to go through 0% as a guideline for the county administrator right now. If you really think these are hard times, then you recognize that it's the county that provides the social safety net services. And as other people have pointed out, our share of the property tax is 20% of what our residents feel they're upset about when they say to you campaigning, keep taxes down. They're thinking more about school taxes. That's the big number. I agree we need to work to keep taxes low, but that doesn't mean that we should take away what we provide in these hard times. And I understand that you want to experience how bad it would look with a 0% cut, but I think you can do that on paper without making Joe and all the department heads do it in preparing a recommended budget. I can't support 0%. I'm with Will at maintenance of effort. 5% for me is as low as I would want to go because of the disastrous kinds of cuts that you will see during the summer in program committees.
Thank you, Julie. Carol.
Yeah, 5% is in essence already a 5.2% less than we need to do what we do now. And that assumes no inflation in costs between now and then to do what we do now. And I, you know, there are many things that are depressed in this economy, but I don't believe for a minute that nothing that we do is going to inflate. Just what we see in the cost of gasoline to run our vehicles at the moment. I believe that our residents need to know that we're still there for them, that we're still here for them, to keep them safe, to help their family members, whether they're dealing with mental health issues or physical issues or economic issues, legal issues, to oversee their water supplies, to keep their tax assessments equitable, to make sure that a gallon of gas really is a gallon of gas as that machine goes ka-ching, 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 and that a pound of beans really is a pound of beans, and to deal with the increased workload that we have, that our staff will have to prepare for, assuming we can't prevent gas drilling. So for those reasons, I am at 5, at least as this target, and I think we will have plenty of opportunity to revisit where we can be, as we know, between now and fall, some of the more specific realities coming at us from the state. So I'm at 5.
Okay, Pat, and maybe we can go to vote on the amendment to change this to 0.
I'd like to say, first of all, that as one of the new legislators here who has not gone through this process with the county, that I'm greatly appreciative of my colleagues' various ways in which I've been supported and helped and encouraged and counseled process as we've gone along so far. It's been a big help to me to, in a fairly steep learning curve as I, have joined the legislature. Having said that, I'd also like to point out that I'm not the only new legislator who has been part of a body of elected officials who have dealt with challenging budgets and challenging times. And not this is not the first time for me that I have had to answer to not only my colleagues, but to constituents and make difficult decisions. So I would just like to put that out there. I want to echo what Peter said. I think that if I am going to have to go back to my constituents in Lansing who are facing very, very difficult choices, particularly with their school budget this year, with all the changes in the AES pilot program, with a significant tax increase from the county, which to me 5% is pretty significant given the rest of the economic situation and given where we are with cost of living and so on, that I need to be able to say exactly why we found it necessary to raise taxes this year and exactly what it is that we are proposing to do with the money that we're going to raise with the increase. I'm very convinced that even if we were to set a 0% levy increase, that it would not end up at zero, that it would probably come in someplace, this is just a guess, but I'm guessing closer to 2 or 3%. However, it's never going to come in at that if we set a goal of 5%. And so for all of those reasons, I'd also like to point out that one of the first lines of thought that was presented here tonight when we first started talking about this was that this is very much a guideline. And so if we were to vote on it without a terrible lot of discussion, we didn't need to worry about that too much because it was only a guideline. It was only when the number became significantly lower that it became so important that we had to put this much time into the discussion. So it makes me wonder, is it really just a guideline? Because my feeling is that if we set 5% tonight, 5%, it's never going to go lower than 5%, and the likelihood is that it'll go higher.
Are we ready to vote on the amendment? Dave, who hasn't spoken. The only one hasn't spoken yet, so.
Okay. I'm not particularly in favor of the 5%. I'd like to see it down around 3. I'm not sure 3 is realistic. And what I would like to ask Joe to do is to present a range of 3 to 5. It shows us what the difference is, what we lose in those 2%. So that would be what I would ask.
All right, we talked about a range in the during the budget retreat, and the budget committee can talk about it. Right now, we have a target, a number. We have an amendment on the table for 0. So let's start with that. That's a suggestion that has been made before. So, all right. All in favor of the amendment to change the number to zero? Please raise your hand. One, two, three. All opposed? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, 10, 11. That's it. Okay, that fails 3 to 11. Mike?
I'd like to move to amend at 2.5%.
Is there a second? Peter, seconds, 2.5. I believe we've kind of had the conversation. I hope if there's nothing... Yeah, I'm going to call on folks, but we can, in the interest of time, remember all the things we've already said. Kathy?
First of all, I'd like to say that I appreciate the efforts of the county administrator and the staff to work through the numbers to give us the recommended budget. Second, I'd like to say I was going to move 2%. 2.5 is in the range that I would go for, so I'll support that, but don't have a lot of leeway, and I agree with a lot of what's been said about wanting to come up with an authentic number that represents us trying to meet the needs of county residents.
Peter, Jim.
I was going to move the previous question.
Move the, I mean, call the question.
Call the question.
Is there a second for that? Okay. All in favor of ending debate by calling the question, please raise your hand.
I'm sorry. Call the question.
We've called the question. All opposed? One opposed. All right. Then it is time to vote on an amendment to 2.5%, same resolution. That's the only change. All in favor of the amendment, please raise your hand. One, two, three, four, five. All opposed? One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine. Okay, the amendment fails 5-9. 5-9. Kathy.
I'd like to move 3%, and if I can get a second, I'll explain why.
3%.
I'll second it.
Okay.
I just want to say that I'm on the budget committee, and in budget today, I did support 5%. Part of the reason was to get it out of committee so that we could discuss this, and I believe that in the interest of transparency, it's fine that we talk about some of our reasonings that were expressed in the budget retreat so that the public can understand some of what our preliminary arguments are. And I believe 3% for me is the maximum that I could go to in a responsible, fiscally prudent budget that's consistent with the direction that we've taken in past years of limiting as much as we can the extensive burden on the taxpayer. But given the system of property taxation, which is inequitable, we've got to respond to it as local government because the buck kind of stops here with Tompkins County. So this is our best way, I think, to respond in tough times to a tough situation, and that's why 3% is as high as I can go this year, given the information we have right now.
I would like to add in here, I will not support this amendment. I think 5 is still the a number that I can live with. Given everything that was said, I will also point out that among Joe's assumptions in the maintenance of effort budget was that there would be no additional cuts from the state, from state or federal funding that we get. And for me, that's a huge assumption. So I think if we constrain ourselves to lower than 5, I'm deeply concerned. I would remind you that 5% is still a $2 million cut to our spending. Jim?
Can I call a question, please?
Okay, is there a second to call any question? Will seconds that. All in favor of calling the question? Any debate? Please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4. That succeeds, that carries 9 to 4. Is that the right number? Somebody didn't vote. What? 10 to 4. 10 to 4, 9 to 5. Well, at any rate, it is time to vote. 3%. All in favor of the amendment to 3%, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. All right. 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So that fails 6 to 8. Thank you. 14 is our number tonight. The main motion is on the table. Carol?
I'd like to call the question on the main
main menu?
Motion.
Is there a second? That's been seconded. Carol. Carol moves to call the question. Will seconds. Okay. All in favor of calling the question on the main motion, please raise your hand. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That carries 8-6.
Point of order?
Yes, sir.
According to our rules, does calling the question require 2/3, or is it just a majority vote?
Majority.
That's different than Roberts.
Simple majority. The main motion is before us for a tax levy increase of 5% as a guideline for the county administrator and staff to work on. There is no discussion. Thought I'd forget. All in favor, please rate.
Checking to see if you're opinion.
Please, it's been a long day. But
I know. That's why I took advantage of it.
All in favor of 5%, please raise your hand. That main motion. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Opposed? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That fails. That carries 8-6. Carries 8-6. Okay, Kathy.
Given the comments from my colleagues about their concerns about budget creep, I'd like to say that with this 5% that so many have expressed concern over, I hope that we can be rigorous in our deliberations and our decisions so that we don't end up with something that would be equivalent to a 10% tax increase.
Agreed. Frank?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joe, I'm sorry I didn't bring that folder with me from the retreat, but off the top of your head, do you recollect what the change in the per thousand rate is from 0 to 5%?
Our tax rate right now is $6 per thousand. This would take it to $6.39 per thousand. So for every $100,000 of value, this would add $39 to a tax bill.
Thank you.
Jim, do you have anything else on the Budget Committee report?
No, we're having a meeting Monday, and the cover, you have to vacate your mind just for a moment. The cover is literally purple on the agenda, but you just can't see it.
Okay, this one. Okay.
Yeah, this is
all right.
Purple.
Okay, thank you, Jim. It looks like people are voting with their feet. Usually we've taken a break by now. We have only one other resolution, but we have committee reports. Would you folks like to take a break? What? And one appointment. Do I hear yes for a 5-minute break?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Be back here at 8 o'clock. Thank you.